Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, this is a We Have Ways of Making You Talk special. I'm here with my pal, Mike Nyberg, Professor Mike Nyberg, I should say, who you have an incredibly grand title, don't you? Because you're Director of War Studies
Chair
at
the
U.S. Army War College at Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
All true.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty impressive, I've got to say. And I love this place because I go to Carlisle quite a lot because everyone should know that this is one of the U.S. archives that is well-trod by people like me, and indeed you, of course, as well, Mike. And there you have all the German foreign studies, which is this incredible program, isn't it, that was done after World War II with these kinds of mid to high ranking German commanders, admittedly most of them army, there's a few Luftwaffe, but most of them army, and just grilling them about every aspect of the war. I mean, it's an incredible series, isn't it?
It's amazing, and sometimes their cells are being bugged and they don't know it, so they'll say one thing to the interrogators, then say something else, and it's all being recorded, so it's a wonderful insight into the mindset at the end of World War II.
Yeah, it really is. And also there's lots of kind of oral history programs and projects and stuff like that. And
we're the archive of the U.S. Army. So we have not only papers and archives, but we have generals when they don't know what to do with their libraries, they come to us. And it really is a phenomenal facility.
Yeah, it really is. And everyone's incredibly helpful there. And you go there and there's these vast desks that you can sit to. And there's a kind of sort of that lovely kind of hushed tone you get in kind of any reading rooms and... You know, it's always very good. So I'm going there with my pal Peter Caddick Adams next week, straight after this, because I should say that we're recording this in the absolutely amazing boardroom here at the Higgins Hotel. And the Higgins Hotel is the kind of endlessly expanding National World War II Museum. And the National World War II Museum here in New Orleans really is, it kind of sort of holds the flame alive, doesn't it, for the kind of cultural heritage of World War II here in the USA.
Absolutely. And it's gone from what I first saw it in 2006 in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina into something that was struggling, as New Orleans was, into this just phenomenal facility in this great neighborhood. So it's quite something to watch the way that it's grown.
Yeah, it sure is. And one of the things that's literally just opened a couple of weeks ago is this new hotel. And it's pretty luxe,
isn't it? It's gorgeous, yeah. It's gorgeous.
And I should just describe. So the boardroom is everything you would expect from a kind of sort of big kind of American boardroom. It's a massive TV screen on one wall. I mean, you know, that is absolutely ginormous. But on one wall, on the other end, you've got that famous photograph of Ike talking to the 101st Airborne. Earlier on, I can't remember if it was the 4th or 5th of June, even 6th of June, but anyway, just before they're all heading off to D-Day. And then on the other wall, you've got a kind of reproduction of Eisenhower's map that was, I think, at Southwark House. And it's just completely brilliant.
It's incredible. We were joking earlier that it looks like a war plan with Legos, so that there's moving tiny ships across the water. And yeah, just to think of the massive size of the operation, and this is the way they were doing it.
And the New Orleans conference that they have every year, I mean, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? Because it's this sort of amazing sort of confluence of historians. And what I've rather liked about it over the last few years is you sort of become kind of pals with people, and you kind of see old friends and chew the cards and have chats like this, and it's really nice, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's a whole group of people, 500 some people, that pay their own money and use their own discretionary time to come here and hear about World War II, and they're enthusiastic and delightful, and it's a great event. And the fact that it's in New Orleans is not too bad.
But I want to talk about, I thought it'd be fun to talk about, you've written about sort of Paris and the liberation of Paris in August 1944. But before we do that, I mean, just a little bit more about Carlisle and the Army War College. I mean, you know, so being director of war studies, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, what are you doing every day?
Well, I think what it means is it means two things. It means being able to be a sort of outreach face for the college. We're in a small town in Pennsylvania. We're near a lot of big American centers, but we're not in any of them. So there is a tendency for the place to be a bit isolated. And my job is to come to things like this, make sure that I'm following what the latest trends are in scholarship, even things like I went to an artificial intelligence seminar at Carnegie Mellon University to try to figure out, are these things we need to bring back to our curriculum? If so, how would it fit with what we're doing? So that's one end of it. And another end of it is to keep me out of what we call the tyranny of the schedule, because it is the Army. Any white space they fill up. So if there's a couple of days for sit and think, they'll put an exercise in there. So my job is to kind of keep me out of that so that I can sort of keep a bird's eye view on where the curriculum is going. And if we want to think about artificial intelligence, who should we be talking to? If we're interested in, you know, executive education programs because our students are in their mid-40s, who's doing that really, really well?
Right.
And then my role, of course, as an historian and continuing to do research that
and writing books.
And writing books. And
But are your students are U.S. Army officers?
They are two-thirds U.S. Army officers. By law, we also have Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, of course. And we have international officers from this year, I think it's 85 officers from 78 countries.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. So I think that is a bit the same. I think that's a similar story at Tribunum at the...
it's really important.
Joint Services Combined Staff College.
It's really important. Otherwise, you're just talking with people who share your cultural assumptions and...
Right.
You know, have your same kind of school solutions. So,
yes, and of course, as we know, that's one of the criticisms that kind of American foreign policy
exactly.
is that there's kind of too much kind of our view is the only view.
Yeah, and these folks can really help to do that. So we're broken into seminar groups. This year, my seminar group has Mexico, the Republic of Georgia, and the first officer since the Liberian Army had been rebuilt and recreated and professionalized. So... it's wonderful to get their perspectives, and my job is to figure out where in the curriculum do we want to teach history.
Right.
What do we want to teach them? They don't need to know, you know, pat and turn left instead of right, but
right.
Obviously there are things that we think students need to know,
yep.
And how do we regularize that into a curriculum? So that's really what my job is at the
wow,
college.
I mean, it does sound interesting, I've got to say.
It's a lot of fun. It's
you enjoy it.
I enjoy it. There are days where you sort of wake up and you think, okay, how do I not screw it up today, right? I've got the right students and I've got the right resources.
Okay.
How do I not make a what would you guys say, a dog's breakfast of
right.
this? I mean, how do I ensure that I'm doing it the way that I want to do it? But we've got plenty of help. And
you don't feel swamped by red tape and bureaucracy and
it's
reports.
The Army, so there's always red tape.
Right.
Travel especially. But the Army War College, although it's connected to the U.S. Army, is a reasonably small place. We have 380, 390 students. So it's small enough that I can walk into someone's office and just say, hey, I've got this problem. How do I fix it? What am I doing here?
Okay.
So it's part of a gigantic bureaucracy, but because we're in this small town in Pennsylvania,
you're sort of a bit out on a limb as well.
Fix. Yeah.
And does it give you an opportunity to kind of sort of meet the great and the good and the kind of the, you know, the, you know, McChrystals and Mattises and of this world, you know, the leading
yeah.
military figures in the U.S. Armed Forces in the last
decade
or so. They
do all come through. When they give their talks to the students, they will normally say, this is Chatham House rule, you know, we just keep this between us.
Right.
But very often they'll, you know, General Mattis pulled a few of us aside and said, I'm going to be over at the bar, I'm going to get a drink, come on over, keep it off social media.
But what
do you want to know?
Ever since that email he sent about kind of the importance of reading history went viral, I've just been such a fan of his. I mean, I think he's an amazing guy.
You know, he's the definition of charisma. He's a person that when he walks into a room, you certainly
look,
know it.
Yeah.
And he's the one that everybody's eyes are kind of focused on, and it's a gift. I mean, it
yes.
really is a gift, and you can agree or disagree with some of the things that he advocates. But
of course, but he's a big man.
He has that ability to hold a room in a way
without,
it seems to me, without trying. I'm sure it's a practice skill, too. But we do get 4 stars who come through, the occasional senator, the occasional, and sometimes.
But it must be so fascinating to meet these people because they're always going to have perspectives. They're always going to have things, and you know, I kind of find as a historian, you know, what you always wanting to do is constantly be thinking, constantly sort of challenging yourself, challenging your own assumptions and your own views, and that's what makes it exciting, isn't it?
It
stand still.
We really do early in the curriculum try to put them through a battery of materials and curriculum. to try to get them to say, okay, you're 45. This is normally the time in your life when your opinions begin to narrow and solidify.
Right.
But the job you're doing, that's not acceptable. So what intellectual skills do you need to open your mind a little bit more? And I really love that about the way that we do that. We try to teach people where their cognitive biases are just so they know them.
Oh, that's fascinating.
How do you correct for them? How do you make sure that you're going for the answer that will work rather than the one that will intellectually be comfortable to you?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And that's difficult, people our age, middle-aged, 45, 50. I find it getting harder for me. So sometimes I'll go back and reread those materials and say, okay, I have to think of it this way. I can't think of it that way. And,
yeah.
So the idea is at the end of the 11-month program that they come out with a better set of skills for the senior jobs they're going to do in the U.S. military. They're not going to go back to whatever tactical command they've done. They're now going to be on that road to brigadier general or senior colonel, and they're going to be in a job that requires a very different set of skills.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Anyway, to Paris and the liberation in 1944. Because obviously I've been doing all this work on Normandy, and I kind of sort of didn't really bother with it. I got so big, I sort of ended with the Falaise Gap and the closing of that, and I didn't kind of really go onto Paris. But it is such an interesting period, isn't it? Because I think there is this assumption that, you know, Normandy ends, and you know, there's this sort of huge surge of the Allies, and the next minute, you know, they're all kind of sort of hurtling into Paris. But actually,
it wasn't campaigning, kissing on the Champs-Élysées,
all that stuff. But actually, it wasn't like that, and there was quite a sort of hard fought battle. Wasn't there? And there was this whole sort of question mark over Choltitz and whether he was going to destroy Paris as ordered by Hitler. And there was a lot of fighting. I mean, there was a lot of fighting between the resistance and German troops in there, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a competition. Really, I would say once the Falaise pocket is closed. So before that, there's a lot of organization. There's a lot of preparation. People are trying to hoard food and ammunition and weapons and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, quite realistically, there's no point in rising up against the Germans unless you can believe that an American or French division will be somewhat nearby. These people aren't afraid to die. They're not afraid to put themselves in harm's way. But like most people, they don't want to do it for no reason.
Yes.
So there's a sort of biding of time as they're waiting to see what's going to happen. And it's part of what worries the Americans, because most of the hardcore resistance cells in the city are communist. They're people that have been thinking about this for many, many years.
And yes,
there's a sort of fear that you might end up liberating the city only to have the communists take it over. Then what do? Do you really want to send the American army in to clear out Paris? The simple answer is no. And they did plan for what they called AMGOT, for a full occupation of France.
Allied military government of occupied territories.
Absolutely.
You know, it is an occupied territory. I mean, that is an amazingly... I mean, for De Gaulle, that is just anathema to him.
It's like the biggest slap in his face. He could have lit his cigarettes right on his forehead.
Yes.
You know, what he wants is to make sure that it's perfectly clear that when he gets to France... that he is in command of the country, that officials are responding to him, that he can reestablish courts, he can do all of that, and therefore the Americans don't need to be a part of this.
Yes.
And I think that's what Eisenhower wanted too. Just as in North
Africa. Well, he wants a smooth transition.
He wants he wants to move east, just as in North Africa. He doesn't want to deal with the politics of Algiers. He wants to move on to Tunisia.
And actually, you don't really want to have the hassle of running AMGOT, which is a huge drain on resources anyway.
And something the Army's just not prepared for. So the Army's not... They don't know how to do this. So.
But the stumbling block on this is Roosevelt, who thinks, you know, hang on a minute, this guy's... cocky, arrogant little shit.
Yeah.
He's insufferable. He's got sort of... really kind of, you know, he's right wing. He feels a bit dictatorial in kind of stance, outlook, tone. And he does have this plan, doesn't he? Which is, you know, that when the CFLN, the Committee of French National Liberation, which is de Gaulle's political bit of it, you know, when they go in, that, you know, if they were given the kind of the rights to be the provisional government, that they're going to be dictatorial, that they're going to be a one-party state, that they're not going to kind of, you know, sanction democratic elections and all the rest of it. But I always kind of, my view on it is, I think Roosevelt was amazing, but I think he was a bit harsh on him. You know, just because de Gaulle's a pain in the ass doesn't mean to say he's not the right man for the job.
So the issue for Roosevelt, I think, is you have the collapse of the Third Republic in 1940. One option is you could go back and say, look, the Third Republic never really did legally collapse. Vichy was illegitimate.
Yes.
So you're going to go back to the Third Republic. Well, nobody in France wants that. The Third Republic had been discredited long before 1940. Yeah, yeah. You could say...
Yes, because the 1930s, this is a period of coalition governments
terrible.
With kind of sort of 12 parties in the coalition.
And in fact, when France falls, the vast majority of Frenchmen say, well, it's not the army that beat us, it was the politicians that beat us. So you're not going to go back to the Third Republic. Another option that Americans are considering quite late in the game, Admiral Leahy quite late in the game says, look, just take Pétain out of Vichy, make him the figurehead, and we'll just keep going the way we're going.
Yeah.
In other words, a kind of Vichy light. Get rid of Pierre Laval, get rid of Darlan, get rid of the real nasty guys that are in there, but kind of leave it the way that it is. So de Gaulle is this kind of third option. Roosevelt's preferred option is to get early elections in.
Yes.
And when the French people have spoken, then we'll deal with them as a head of state.
Right.
And the Americans go through this guy, Henri Giraud, that turns out to be a disaster.
Yeah.
So Roosevelt's opinion is we can recognize de Gaulle as a military leader in France.
Yes.
But that's basically what he is. He's a brigadier general. That's all he is.
Yes.
And there's this wonderful anecdote. In July 1944, de Gaulle came to the United States and gave to Franklin Roosevelt a model of the, I think it was the Jean Bart, one of the French battleships that the Americans had agreed to refurbish and get back into the water for the French Navy. So he gives him this thing, and as soon as de Gaulle leaves, FDR says, well, we're going to give this to my grandson. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, you can't. That's a gift from a chief of state. You don't give it to a kid. And Roosevelt is supposed to have shot back. He's not a chief of state. He's the president of some committee. You know, he doesn't get to that level, right?
Yeah.
He's not a head of state yet. And to de Gaulle, I mean, I've often said this. If I were French, I would want de Gaulle's name on every street in the country in 1944. If I'm American, I understand why people wanted him thrown in jail. I mean, he had a really difficult way of not compromising on issues.
Yeah, and he was terribly touchy, gone in half about the smallest slights and the smallest things.
Yeah.
Doesn't help himself at all, doesn't win friends. But he has this vision and he has this determination and he has that charisma, which I think he's really, really admirable and is absolutely right for this kind of rehabilitation of France. And he does rehabilitate France afterwards. I think also what's really interesting is that, you know, you have the council, the National Council of the Resistance, the CNR, which is formed at the end of May 1943. And this is the sort of great work of Jean Moulin.
Exactly.
Who is left-wing, but has realised that actually de Gaulle is the figurehead under which all resistance should form. And of course, the problem you have in the early years is there's no hope.
Yeah.
And you know, most, and also the privations of occupation haven't really kicked in kind of 1940, 1941. It's only until sort of 1942, 43 that the true horrors of being occupied by the Germans and the Vichy government really come home to roost. So that is when, you know, people are only going to put their necks on the line if there is... What they've already got is so intolerable, there is no alternative. And there is some hope.
There has to be some hope.
There has to be some sense
that somebody's coming to help you.
But Moulin recognises that resistance needs to be attempted to be unified. And this is what the CNR does. And what's interesting, although it is under the directive of de Gaulle to create this national body of resistance and that sort of, you know, and the kind of outlaw political parties in France, across the board, from communists to right-wingers to all the rest of it, to centrists, then they splinter again, and particularly following the death of Moulin in early July 1943. So by the spring of 1944, when you've also got this sort of rising conflict between the resistance and the Maquisard against the milice, you know, this paramilitary organisation by Joseph Danin and stuff, you've also got this kind of really interesting period where they do their kind of programme for action that they announce, which is total odds to what de Gaulle is saying.
Right.
And suddenly you've got this three-way battle because the Allies have no interest in harnessing the resistance at all unless it is 100% on their terms.
Right. They don't want a communist resistance. They don't want an FTP, the real left-wing.
They
don't want those guys running around. What they want, and I think what Jean Moulin was working to, was a kind of thinking two steps ahead. What will this look like at the end of the war?
Yes.
What will the political system look like? So Jean Moulin, working with Charles de Gaulle, and later Henri Roltanguy, who's the great FTP head in Paris, what they're saying is, look, yes, step one is let's kill the Germans and get them out of here.
Yeah.
Step two is open, fair, and free elections, and whoever wins it, we respect it. We'll figure the system out, but we're not going back to the Third Republic.
Yeah.
We're going to build a system whereby the politics can work a little bit better. Now, those of you that know French history know they don't quite get that right in the Fourth Republic, and de Gaulle doesn't want to be a part of it because the parliament he feels is too strong, and they're going to have to go and do this again in the Fifth Republic in 1958. But the notion that those three men had was, we're not going to let this go into civil war. We're going to get rid of Vichy. We're going to settle matters here inside France legally, and then we're going to rewrite this constitution. So if that deal holds, you're fine.
Yeah.
Right? If, on the other hand, the Soviet Union is able to play a card or the American occupation is too heavy-handed, then you have a problem. And the Americans are really, really worried about this. If we come in, either we're seen as too heavy-handed or just another occupier, or de Gaulle is seen as just another foreign-backed ruler, we face that problem.
Yeah. And it's and when you're not born there and brought up there, you don't have that cultural insight, particularly in a world where, you know, it is a media world, but it's not the media world that it is as we know it today. So you just don't have those insights in a way. But I, what I find just so fascinating is you've got these three strands in the spring of 1944 as we're building up towards D-Day. You've got the resistance movement over in France with the kind of FFI that's been formed, the, you know, the French Forces of the Interior. You've still got the CNR. You've got COMAC as well, which is this other force, this sort of military bit of the CNR under which is the FFI. So it all gets quite complicated.
It's really complicated.
But what you've got, of course, those guys are all living it. They're there in France. They can see what the Milice are doing and the 200,000 occupation troops. They can see the kind of sort of, you know, the brutality of the occupation. They've also got this sort of passionate kind of romantic vision of the future that it's going to be democracy and all the rest of it and no corruption. De Gaulle, who is still with the CFLN, is still in Algiers. That's where his headquarters is after, you know...
Which is France to them.
Which is France to them. But he's away from that. So he can look at this a little bit more dispassionately. He's still very passionate, but there is greater amounts of dispassion there.
He has that political view that Giraud never had, that Laval never had.
Yes, and he has a pragmatism, right?
Yep, exactly. And I think the other thing that is really critical in the way that these resistance guys are thinking is, to their mind, yes, the Milice is a problem, yes, the Germans are the problem, but the core problem are the collaborationists who have used the Germans to grab power for themselves.
Right.
The Germans will eventually go home.
Yes.
The Milice will fade into the background or will make it so that they keep their mouths shut forever.
Yes.
But the people you're going to have to deal with are going to be the Catholic Church, the industrialists,
the
people
who industry,
are not
yes.
going to go away. And how do you want to deal with that?
Right.
And that's where de Gaulle comes in and says, look, the shaving of the women's heads, the extra legal execution on the streets, we're putting a stop to that. There's going to be a state-based judicial process for this.
Right.
But that's the real question. I mean, it's your neighbor, right? It's the guy who lived in the apartment next to you that you know was giving the names of French resistance people to the Germans or selling out the Jews in the next building so he could take their apartment. I mean, those people aren't going anywhere. What are you going to do with them at the end of the war?
Yes.
That's the really big question.
Hello, it's James Holland here. While I've got your attention, I hope you won't mind me mentioning a book I wrote called Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. You may have heard me mention this before, but I hate to say it, Christmas is getting nearer. And if you're thinking of what to buy for those with an interest in history, and especially those fascinated, as Al and I are, by the Second World War, well, perhaps this might be something to consider. I mean, I don't want to appear pushy or anything. This is just a mention, nothing more. I think there's something for everyone in it. Bags of human drama, plenty of easy-to-follow analysis, a bit of myth-busting, pictures, maps, and I hope all put together in a way that makes for a fascinating and fast-paced read. That's the aim, at any rate. And should this be a book that is stirring interest, then it's very easy to buy. From Waterstones, Amazon, or any bookshop throughout our great land. Thank you, and happy Christmas. On one hand, you've got resistance, who are there living and breathing it in the spring of 1944, before D-Day happens. And Dragoon and all the rest of it, the liberation of Paris. So their vision is much more sort of... it's much more sort of romantic in
it's
a way.
Localized.
But it's also much more kind of sort of... it's much more localised, yeah.
And they don't have
whereas de Gaulle is kind of sort of... He's distanced from it a bit because he's in Algiers.
Political vision, right?
And he's going, actually, the most important thing is we just have a smooth transition of power. He's much more pragmatic.
Yeah.
Then you've got the Allies who are just ruthless. And, yeah, okay, we're very happy to use resistance, but we're only going to help the guys that are going to help us.
Right.
You know, so blocking forces from Limoges or kind of east, you know, in Brittany, that would be great. And we'll get lots of people to kind of say that the resistance don't run amok. Everyone else, we're just going to kind of throw to the walls.
Right.
And you know, I found this diary of this guy who was in the Maquis-Surcouf, which was in kind of eastern part of Normandy. absolutely abandoned. I mean, totally abandoned. Every day expecting arms drops that never come. Yeah. And that's because the last thing the Allies want is lots of sort of, you know, ill-trained resistance types kind of wandering around with Sten guns. I mean
it's not a bad rule in life. Don't give heavy weapons to people you don't know. I mean, it's not a bad rule in life.
No. You can really understand it. But at the end of it, when it comes to Paris, what that means is you know, sort of Bradley and Eisenhower, you know, Paris is not the kind of sort of, you know, the last thing I want to do is get sucked into kind of a big battle in a major city. You know, the plan is to bypass it, isn't it?
Troops that I've been training for amphibious landing, I'm not going to put them into an urban environment like that.
Right.
And expect for the best.
But the resistance in Paris don't know that, do they?
They don't know that. I mean, I my guess is some of them with military backgrounds like Henri Roll-Tanguy have probably figured that out. What they're really afraid of is that the German response to that will be an aerial bombardment of the city. Just kill everything that's in the city, no matter who it is, and don't worry about it. There's certainly a fear of that, because that's the only thing the Germans really can do. What saves Paris, in effect, in part, is that the Germans have already begun to think of Paris as a kind of wheelhouse, a kind of roundhouse,
right,
to get all those troops at Mortain and west of Paris, to get them safely through to the east.
Right.
That's the goal of Paris.
Right.
But the resistance folks, I mean, you can read. I mean, they know what happened in Warsaw. They know that the Germans and even liberating forces could very well find themselves trapped in a battle that will destroy major parts of this city.
Yeah.
And they're not worried about the Eiffel Tower as much as they are food and
right,
you know, where
right,
are we going to live and what are we going to, you know. So those are very real concerns. And I think part of the elation that you see from Parisians in their face is it's not just, yeah, the Germans are gone, but we escaped this without the fate of Warsaw, without the fate of Caen, without the fate of Lisieux,
right,
without the fate of Saint-Lô. I mean,
yeah,
we made it out. And then, you know, there is the question of what these resistance folks are going to do. Some of them, of course, just go into the background, but a number of them go and join de Gaulle's forces. They form battalions. They join the Free French. They march to Strasbourg.
Yep.
They go into Germany. They accept the military discipline, you know, in part, I think, because they're desperate to play a role in erasing that national humiliation and that personal humiliation
that
they felt for so long. And so it's, you know,
it's so nuanced, isn't it?
It's so hard. It is, you know, it's a cheap line, but it is the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, it is the absolute depths of France. And then it is this effort by Frenchmen to say, what can I do? How can I erase this? And I think your earlier point is exactly right. In August 1941, it doesn't say, let's say May 1941, even when the Soviets and Germans are still allies, it makes no sense to begin a major uprising. It just doesn't make sense. August 44? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the kind of, you know, the people who sort of swell to resistance ranks get criticized for being the kind of resistance of the month of September.
Yeah, the RMA.
But I was kind of, you know, my view on that's a little bit harsh, because actually the most dangerous time to be a resistant was in the summer of 1944. I mean, you know, you look at thinking about Tula and Vercors and Oradour and all those sort of appalling atrocities that happen and the kinds of absolutely brutal battles that are taking place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a dangerous old business being a resistant
Very
guy.
Dangerous.
And it's dangerous in Paris, isn't it? In those days of the third week of August
1944. Absolutely. I mean, the urban and rural systems are completely different. I mean, the way you have to think about resistance, the way you have to think about protecting yourself and your equipment. In a certain way, cities are easier. This city is easier because so many of the FTP guys had worked in the underground. They'd worked in the metro. So they knew that world. They knew they could cut power. They knew they could cut telephone communications. They knew how to do that. In other ways, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. Every face you pass could potentially turn you in. And men like Pierre Brossolette, who is turned in and throws himself out of a third-story window on the Avenue Foch so he doesn't give anything away under torture and, you know, It's an unimaginable thing to try to get your head around and to think of, you know, maybe this bit of my Francophilia coming through, but a country that did nothing to start this war.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're in the war because an enemy nation invades you. You can talk about the Treaty of Versailles and whatever else, but not a country that was seeking war.
Yeah.
And now here you are enduring this, and you're enduring starvation conditions and all of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the sort of the huge errors that the Germans make, of course, is that they're like kids in sweet shops, and, you know, in all these occupied territories, they, you know, I mean, France goes from being the most automotive society in Europe by a country mile on the 1st of January 1940 to having 8% of the vehicles in France that it has at the end of the year. You know, so that's a 92% drop, and that's because the Germans have nicked them all.
Right.
They've stolen, taken them. And, you know, it's at every level.
And at first they're told, and they do, when they first go in, you're going to pay for everything, you're going to tip heavily, you're going to open doors for ladies, you know. okay, that's fine until 1942. The Americans and British have invaded North Africa. Now we have to occupy all of Vichy. We're going to requisition food. We're going to requisition labor. We're going to requisition... Then it starts to get, okay, this is not as pleasant an occupation as we intend. It's certainly not Warsaw. It's certainly not Ukraine.
Yep.
But you can't sustain that, you know, I'll overpay. It just doesn't work.
And you've also got this problem that the Germans are so short of workers and laborers, so they then start pushing Vichy into kind of, you know, first of all, the Relev scheme.
They end up arresting young men in the movie theaters, right?
The STO.
They end up, you know, hey, you're in the movie theater, you look pretty healthy, you know, and they end up arresting these guys.
Yeah, taking them to Germany.
You chewed gum or whatever, and they arrest them, and then the punishment is they go to a labor camp in Germany. They go to a factory in Germany.
And that's, of course, another reason why the sort of the Maquis suddenly enlarges, because, you know, if you're 20 years old, you can either do your service de travail obligatoire, you know, obligatory compulsory work service in Germany, where you know you're going to be shat on and treated like dirt and underfed and worked to the grave. Or you can run to the hills and become an outlaw.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, that is the choice. And you know, you're thinking, well, it's 1943, you know, Germany's suffering lots of defeats, this can't go on forever, you know, well, you know.
Right.
I'll take my part. And rather than being on your own, there's a kind of sort of security in numbers, so you think, well, okay, we're in numbers now, but that also makes us vulnerable, so therefore we better arm ourselves and, you know, let's do stuff. And, you know, you can see how it kind of sort of builds from that.
Absolutely. And they're collective decisions. They're sometimes rational, sometimes not rational, but decisions, but... you know, it's I try really, really, really hard when I'm an historian not to second guess what people do, because I've never had to live that. Thank heavens I've never had to live that, and thank heavens I never will. But, you know, people that are in the occupied zone, that have family in the unoccupied zone, you know, sick parents or children or whatever, and, you know, everybody's looking for a way to kind of make it through this.
Yes.
So I, you know, you have to come up with tremendous respect for men like Jean Moulin, who are told, you're going to blame this German atrocity on these Senegalese troops. And Jean Moulin says, no, I won't. It was clearly the Germans who did it. I'm not going to blame these African soldiers.
Then he tries to kill himself, cutting his neck.
He takes a piece of glass and tries to, you know, which is why he's usually photographed with a scarf by the end of the war, so that he can't be identified by that scar. And these are astonishingly brave people.
Yes.
And well deserving of our admiration.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And it's happening within this giant drama around them, where the other thing I like to see, you know, we as historians can reconstruct this chronology fairly well. I mean, I really wonder what these poor guys in Vercors, how clear a picture did they have of Stalingrad, of North Africa? Did they know this was starting to come to an end?
And
if they didn't, you know, more power to them, more credit to them.
Yeah.
You know, but
I mean, the Vercors operation is extraordinary, isn't it? Because, I mean, what are we talking about? End of June 1944.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a pretty large Maquis organization up there, and civilians in this sort of high ground in southeast France,
and it's
10,000 troops sent to kind of sort them out, and this battle takes place. What is it? 340-odd Maquisard killed, 120 civilians. They're just left there in the roads. You know,
I have a good friend of mine who just bought a holiday house down there. He's a French officer who bought a place, and he said, you know, every place he looked at, he would ask, you know, I want to know what happened during the Vercors uprising and what happened here during the Vercors uprising. And of course, most of the real estate agents either didn't know or didn't care. But he finally found someone who cared about this and had documented these houses and what had happened in these. And this was a Maquis safe house, or this was a Milice space, or, you know, whatever the case might be. And it's everywhere throughout the region. So, you know, history and memory is another thing that is difficult for France. I mean, I remember I'm doing this book on Vichy France now, so I was Googling Vichy because I was going to be in France. And I came across the Vichy tourism website.
Right.
So I look at it, and it's all, you know, the beautiful river and the spas and whatever. And there's a little contact me, so I write a letter in my best French, and I said, I'm really interested in seeing the stuff from the 1940s. And I get this letter back, oh, monsieur, there's nothing here from the 1940s. You know, our spas are lovely, and the river's lovely. I mean, they just, for obvious reasons, they don't want to make this an attraction the way that Oradour is, or it's not quite the same thing, but the way that Auschwitz is. You know, they don't want people coming there to see all the evil that and all the bad that had happened there. But it gets to the questions of French memory. Those are difficult things.
Yes. Well, unbelievable. I just don't know how Britain would have coped. I really don't. I mean, it's this terrible stain, isn't it? And how you coexist with people that you were fighting just a year before. I mean,
you have to create these fictions that it really was the Germans and they forced this on us and we didn't mean to do this. It was the Germans making us do it. And, you know, politically it makes a certain level of sense. You know, historically, as any you and I and so many of our colleagues know, it's complete hogwash.
Yeah.
You know, but...
But God, fascinating research. So earlier on, you and I were talking about kind of, you know, how one goes about researching and stuff, but I wasn't... You were asking me the questions rather than the other way around. So what? How are you finding out about Vichy? I mean, where are the... There are French archives, obviously, in Paris.
Absolutely.
You know, what are you doing? Where are you doing that?
So I don't think anybody was hiding these records, but the French archives have, in the past 10, 15 years, moved from these beautiful old... pre-revolutionary palaces that don't work as an archive to modern-built, brutalist, ugly buildings that work beautifully as an archive.
Okay, so great. So where are those now?
There's a trade-off. So the main one that I've been working in is in a place called La Courneuve, which is in between Charles de Gaulle Airport and Paris on the same RER line. And it's where the foreign ministry papers are.
Right.
And, you know, whenever you're dealing with Germany or Italy or France, I mean, you can be pretty well sure that not everything made it into the archive, into the record that should have. Okay, sometimes you can see where those gaps are.
Yep.
But most of the foreign ministry papers are there. There's a collection in the Bibliothèque Nationale, the François Mitterrand Library, of the kind of updates of what the cabinet and what the leadership were being told was happening. And then I'm just told I'll be back there in March. A friend of a friend from the museum here, the World War I Museum in Kansas City. There is a collection in the Pierrefitte, which is another one of these new custom-built things, where they actually have some of Pétain's personal papers.
Wow.
So the French sources I've been working from have been mostly those. The British sources, Harold Macmillan, the future prime minister, was the minister resident in Algeria.
Yeah, so he's got lots of stuff, hasn't he?
And it's all the Bodleian, and I've been able to look at a lot of that.
And Robert Murphy and all
Robert
that?
Robert Murphy's papers are at the Army War College, so are
Leahy's. That's quite handy.
William Leahy's are there. Bill Donovan, one of the first spies.
Yes.
Donovan was working with a young...
He's
British.
A rather cool guy.
He's a really cool guy. He was working with a young...
First World War hero.
Yeah.
Pale blue eyes, dashingly good looking.
Ran for governor.
Outdoorsman.
Told Hitler he was thinking of converting to Judaism just to piss Hitler off. But he was friends with a British naval officer named Ian Fleming, and they set up a spy network called GoldenEye, and so there's a lot of fun stuff going on.
And he was also over in Britain in 1940 as a personal representative of Roosevelt.
With a lot of speculation that he was going to replace Joseph Kennedy as the ambassador.
Yeah, anyone better than him.
So that there's no shortage of interesting people, there's no shortage of interesting stuff, and from the American side anyway... You know, the collapse of France destroys every single strategic assumption the country had made about its own defense.
Yes.
So it really is a moment where everybody wakes up and just says, holy blank, what do we do now?
Yes.
I mean, everything from, you know, Roosevelt writes a letter to the Attorney General shortly after the fall of France and says, hey, I know the Supreme Court 6 months ago said that wiretaps violated Fourth Amendment protections. I don't think they had any military thing in mind when this happened. Go ahead and ignore that. Right, we're just going to do it differently.
Yeah.
And all of these, you know, the conscription, the Destroyers for Bases Agreement, the Two Ocean Navy Act, are these very fast reactions to what the hell do we do, not only now that France is gone, but what if the Germans seize the French Navy, a modern, big Navy?
Okay, so where do you sit on the whole kind of Merzel-Kabir issue? So for those who don't know, this is, I think it's beginning of July, 1940, and a lot of the French fleet is in Merzel-Kabir, near Iran in Algeria, and the British go, hand it over or else we're going to blast you to pieces, and the French just go, no. So the British blast them to pieces.
Yeah. So it certainly created a problem from the American side, because Roosevelt has to say, look, Vichy's technically a neutral nation, you Brits can't do that. Secretly, the Americans are saying, great, that's whatever it was, four capital ships that we don't have to worry about being transferred to the Germans. The bigger, longer issue, as you well know, it makes it really, really hard for the United States to go to Vichy and say, look, we're going to build this Anglo-French-American alliance. We're going to liberate you. And the Vichy officers in North Africa who say, look, if we see Americans, we will welcome them. If we see Brits, we're going to shoot them. So Torch has to be very carefully designed and edged. And, I think that if, correct me if I'm wrong, the admiral who ran that operation thought it was a really stupid idea. The British admiral who ran it.
Yeah, Somerville.
Somerville thought this had been...
Well, for large emotional reasons, which is that you know, they're colleagues. I mean, they've been allies. They all know each other. They've been on exercises together. They're personal friends. Yeah. And Somerville is just sort of going, don't be so stupid.
Yeah.
You know, just hand over your ships. You know, just, you know.
So I think that's the issue.
And
right?
I think there's a huge frustration from some of us. Well, you know, and he gives the order to fire with kind of a very, very heavy heart, as you would do. You know, I can't remember how many people he's killed, but it's like 1,300 killed. It's a lot of French sailors.
So there's a French aircraft carrier that's in Martinique. The only French aircraft carrier is in Martinique. And the Americans are really worried about it because it could launch an attack on the Panama Canal. It could support operations in Latin America. They don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So they call these meetings with some Vichy people. They actually go to Martinique to talk to the admiral. And they never say, we could Mers El Kabir you. But they do say things like, if we can't get this to a satisfactory resolution, we may have to take matters into our own hands.
Right.
And it's enough to convince the French. They cut this deal where they take the airplanes off the ship, and they literally just leave the airplanes on the beach to just rot in the salt and sand.
Right.
And then they allow an American admiral to come on and inspect and make sure everything's being done the right way. But they won't let the ship come to the United States. It has to stay under French command. And the Americans can live with that. But
obviously Martinique is the other side of the Atlantic from Europe.
But it's very close to the United States.
Yes, it is. But Algeria, you know, but a lone aircraft carrier on its own is kind of, you know, how much danger is that going to be? But a sizable surface fleet in the Mediterranean, that's a different kettle of fish.
I mean, it's certainly, you know, we were talking about this earlier, the tactical, strategic, operational. On the tactical level, it makes a lot of sense. On the operational level, it probably makes a lot of sense. On the strategic,
there's a few more question marks.
You have to, you've got to be worried about what the second, third order effects of that are going to be and how you're going to manage it. Jean-François Darnelon, the head of the Vichy military, was a Navy guy. He had built that fleet in the 30s.
He is Admiral Dunn.
He's the guy that built that fleet, despite the fact that there was no money in the French budget and the government wanted it going elsewhere. And he is... I mean, people describe him as purple with rage if the British Navy is even mentioned. So, you know, those are issues. You know, those are the calls that people like Churchill have to make. And
tough decisions, you know, goodness me.
We had an American four-star general come to the Army War College, and he said, big strategic decisions, he said, are 55-45 ventures always.
Yes.
He said, if you get lucky and you read and you study and you listen to the right advice, you might get it to 60-40. But he said, it's your job to know that if you get it wrong, they're coming for your head. Just be ready for it. There is no such thing as a 100% certain strategic decision. They don't exist.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, on that note, Mike, brilliant. That's been just so interesting. I mean, you know, we love this stuff and we can talk about it all day, but we better not, because that seems to me like the perfect point to end our little chat. But thank you so much for coming on.
And see you in Carlisle. We'll continue the discussion there.
Yeah, you bet. That would be great. Thank you.